Welcome to call us at 412-268-WRCT. That's 268-9728 or 89728 on campus at Carnegie Mellon University. And you can send us email also at sendmail to bob@leftout.info.
So today we have a guest on the line for our first segment. His name is Bob Perry. Bob, are you there? Oops.
Hello?
Oh, hello. Bob, hello. Yes. I'm Danny Slater. And
I'm Bob Harper. And you're listening to Left Out, which is on WRCT Radio at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh.
So, Bob, I heard your segment, your interview before a few days ago on Democracy Now!, and I'd like to go over some of the discussion, some of the issues you raised in that discussion. So maybe you could just very briefly say a little about yourself and what your history as a reporter and what you've been doing.
Right. Well, I've been a reporter pretty much since I left college in the early 1970s. I was with the Associated Press for a number of years. Was moved to Washington for their national operation in 77. Was put on their special assignment investigative unit at the end of 1980. During the 1980s, I guess I was perhaps best known for having written the first stories about Oliver North's secret Contra supply operations, which fed into the story now known as Iran-Contra. I went to Newsweek in 87, worked there for several years, still covering a lot of the Iran-Contra matter. Worked for PBS Frontline for a while. Have started my own internet site with one of my sons, actually, who had told me about this strange thing called the internet in the mid-90s. And we started one of the first magazines, an investigative news magazine called the Consortium News, which still exists today.
ConsortiumNews.com, right?
Right. And I worked for Bloomberg News for a while as an editor, covering handling corporate scandal issues for them, and have just written a book, my third or fourth book, depending how you count them, entitled Secrecy and Privilege, Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq.
So one of the issues that you talked about really eloquently, I thought, had to do with the right wing, the way the right has used the media, and contrasting that with and what they've done with it and the effectiveness of it, and contrasting that with what's happened on the left and also the reasons for this. So,
right, and Secrecy and Privilege and other things I've written, I've gone back through and shown how we now can construct, based on the evidence and documents and interviews, what the conservatives were up to. Following Watergate in the mid-1970s, when Nixon was forced out of office, and following the defeat in Vietnam, which some conservatives blamed on anti-war demonstrators and on the media for the Pentagon Papers and reporting on problems with the Vietnam War, the conservatives set about to build their own infrastructure. They built think tanks and expanded their think tanks. They pulled together some of the conservative foundations. A key figure in this was Bill Simon, the former Treasury Secretary, who was able to solicit and create a lot more unity among the conservative foundations to support think tanks, media outlets, and attack groups. And so they would operate in various ways. They were increasingly well-financed going through the late 70s. And then with Reagan and Bush's ascension in the early 1980s, there was a lot more collaboration with the federal government to help expand these operations. Reverend Moon, the South Korean theocrat, entered the picture in a big way in the early 1980s as well, financing the Washington Times, spending hundreds of millions of dollars on his projects, his media projects. And so you have this building of this momentum that continues on through to the present.
And
Fox
locally,
coming on.
Yeah, locally here in Pittsburgh, we have a paper called the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, which was founded by another right wing.
Richard Mellon Scaife, I'm sure you know.
Right. Scaife was certainly part of the picture. But in my view, Scaife was not as principal a figure as some people would have us believe. He was an important figure, but there were other foundations, and I think Moon and later Rupert Murdoch exceeded Scaife in terms of amounts of money poured into this infrastructure. And the effect of this infrastructure was exaggerated because the liberal side essentially didn't engage. There was a general resistance among liberal funders, the foundations that might be at the left of center foundations, to invest in media. They want to invest in activism or in projects like protecting wetlands or AIDS research and things of that sort. So you had the conservatives building up this very powerful, aggressive media structure, while the liberals essentially did very little. You had, in the other course, and of course, you had the mainstream press, which I was part of, which, you know, was not liberal. It was called the liberal press, but it was essentially very, it tried to be centrist. The reporters were under a lot of pressure. The attack groups often focused on reporters and tried to destroy the careers of reporters who were reporting information that presented the Reagan-Bush administration in a negative light. So you had this cumulative effect of the mainstream press shifting to the right as a means of getting protection, as well as the corporate executives wanting to go in that direction. You had this major conservative media being built up, and on the liberal side, you had very little response.
So what has been the result? What has been the end result, in your view, of all of this immense building process that's gone on?
Well, there's been a huge imbalance created in the U.S. political system. We saw this developing in the 80s, coming out of the Iran-Contra period, when Iran-Contra was very much a contained scandal compared to Watergate, which led to the president's removal. Iran-Contra was essentially stopped by 87, 88. So you had this ability now of the conservatives to control the agenda around scandal, and they showed that on the offensive way during the Clinton years, where they were able to create scandal, you know, use Clinton's mistakes very much against him and exaggerate them to the point that they impeached him. The Republicans were able to impeach him in 98, and then he was able to win the Senate trial in 99. But the effect of that then carried on to the 2000 election, where, and in Secrecy and Privilege, I go through some of this too, where at this point, the Washington Times is in some ways doing much of the same thing that the New York Times is doing in terms of criticizing Gore, attacking him for alleged exaggerations. Much of that resulted just from bad reporting. So you had Gore constantly on the defensive. By comparison, George W. Bush was given a fairly light treatment by the press during the 2000 campaign.
Right.
And during the recount battle, there was a general pressure on Gore to withdraw. So you had this movement that then we now see leading up to things like the Iraq War, where the press corps does a particularly terrible job in piercing through the deceptions and propaganda that was being presented in 2002 and early 2003. So this is the consequence of what you have when you have one side engaging and investing heavily and the other side essentially taking a walk.
Now, I think, you know, the right-wing position on this is that it's sort of ludicrous for you to say that the left hasn't done anything because the left controls all of the media to begin with, and they were just getting a little bit of their own.
Well, that was certainly their view coming out of them in the mid-70s,
yeah.
when Nixon was forced out of office over Watergate. But much of that was based on sort of mythology. Nixon was forced out over Watergate because he was guilty.
Yeah,
The Vietnam
That's
War.
A detail.
I mean, we now know the Vietnam War wasn't lost because of the press corps. It was lost because McNamara and Johnson had a terrible plan that wasn't going to go anywhere, and that they internally knew wasn't going to work. So they were kind of just stretching it out, trying to hope for the best. So the idea that the press was liberal even during those periods is not supported by the factual record. And what really happens, and having been in it, I can tell you this personally, that I've been here for 27 years, and there is no liberal press in Washington to speak of. Maybe the Nation magazine has this little broken down office over on in the Methodist Building over on Capitol Hill.
How dare you insult my favorite magazine?
Well, you should be in the office. It's pretty broken down. But in terms of the major news media, mostly it's corporate. So you have, like, for instance, NBC, run by General Electric, which for a long time was run by Welch, who was very much a pro-Republican conservative. And you see this across the board, really, that the corporations run these media outlets. The conservatives have cited the fact that they claim that most reporters in surveys have voted for the Democrat over the Republican.
Oh, that's a favorite statistic.
But the reality is that reporters have very little say. That reporters are basically given assignments, their careers are moved ahead or ended based on what the senior editors and the executives of any news organization want. So the idea that little reporters are running the show is just preposterous.
Yeah. So what has been – do you have any knowledge – it sounds like you may have some inside knowledge about the attempts of Air America and other liberal outlets to do fundraising from foundations and from individuals. But what has been the response to that and why?
Well, one of the people who was involved in sort of forming Air America was this fellow Sheldon Drobny, who's a venture capitalist from Chicago. And he's a liberal, and he's sort of a well-meaning fellow. He tried to present and promote this idea of having a liberal AM radio station to counter what is, I think, we all would agree, is pretty much a monopoly of
mm-hmm,
conservative
right.
or right-wing talk radio. His proposal, however, met essentially a very cold reception when he went to the liberal bastions of Hollywood and to New York. Most of those, what he calls limousine liberals, just weren't interested. They didn't really see the need for it or didn't think it would work or whatever their problem was. They just didn't want to do it. So he had to basically find some other way. He had to sell part of it to someone else, and it did stumble onto the air earlier this year. It was badly underfunded. There were some serious internal problems because of the underfunding issue. It's been fairly successful in the few cities it's on, but it has not gotten nearly the distribution that could have happened.
To expect a station or a network to start out without a big burst of real money is unrealistic, I guess.
Right, it is. I mean,
to have it bootstrap its way up just from revenues from advertising, that's going to take forever.
Right, and there are always mistakes that people make in a business where they might assume one thing will happen and it doesn't. So they have to have a certain amount of reserve of capital
right.
to overcome those problems.
So how do you explain resistance from wealthy people whose political views would seem to be in line with, say, something like Air America or Drobny's proposal? How do you explain the resistance?
Well, I think it's a couple of things. Somewhat it's sort of a bad analysis of the problem, and somewhat it's fear. Many of these liberals prefer doing things like buying up endangered wetlands, which, you know, will get them a pat on the head. No one's who's going to fault doing that. Now, one might argue that the way things are going, those wetlands will be the bottom of the ocean in a few years. But in the meantime, they will get some good publicity for doing a good deed. There's also, I think, a fear of challenging, especially the Bush family and the power structure around the Bush family in any direct way.
Well, that's,
media.
Yeah.
I think there are ways you can do that through the political process, and so many of them supported Gore or Kerry. But the idea of going and building a news media or media infrastructure that challenges them day in, day out, I think is a bit scary for people. Plus, I think some of them felt that it financially would just eat up a lot of money and they didn't want to invest in it.
So one of the stories we had listed on our webpage had to do with the way the media backed down. Well, this is related to what you just said. The media backing down from stories that were, well, what the word was that they didn't want to present the story too close to the election. There was a CBS News pulled a story about the Niger.
Right, the yellow
and,
cake.
And
right.
then the New York Times pulled a story about the bulge on Bush's back during the debates, which were analyzed by a NASA scientist, and they pulled that story. So the that's an example of challenging Bush, which, you know, is something they're loath to do.
There's a great deal of fear, and I think it's not an irrational fear. If you had worked in Washington as a journalist or in these kinds of areas, you would realize that you're always taking your career in your hands when you challenge these folks. And often the stories are murky sometimes. And people, you know, it's not always a case that stories have big neon lights saying this is true on them. Sometimes you're dealing with conflicting information. Sometimes you're trying to figure your way through it. And if you're in a position that where you're vulnerable to attack and sort of this hypercriticism that can be brought to bear by some of these attack groups, reporters are scared and their editors are scared, and often the people in the top of the organizations are sympathetic to Bush or Reagan to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So they don't really want those stories, and if you insist on trying to push them through, you're going really uphill. And people lost careers. A lot of people lost careers during the 1980s. I go through some of this in Secrecy and Privilege.
Okay,
a number of cases where people's careers ended because they did stories that were true but came under fierce attack, and their superiors just went back them.
Do you have a favorite example of that?
Well, there was a fellow who was working at NPR in the mid 1980s, and NPR put out a story about a Contra massacre. The story was really about it was an on the scene report of a village in Nicaragua where many of the men were killed by a Contra massacre attack, and it was about the funeral essentially. And mm-hmm. after NPR put that on, there was a group that the Reagan administration organized called this Public Diplomacy Team, led by Otto Reich, who has since become a figure in the current Bush administration. And Reich and one of his people went over to NPR, and they did at offices around Washington, during this period, and demanded some kind of response from NPR because the Reagan administration claimed that NPR was anti-Contra. They'd put on more anti-Contra minutes than pro-Contra minutes, as they said.
Jeez.
And so this guy who was the foreign editor, named Paul Allen, was his next time around to get his review, he was told this was a big mark against him, and he left journalism. So you have this, and that kind of experience was
and that's at NPR.
That's at NPR.
Right, the big left.
Well, yeah. NPR, of course, was partially government financed.
Right.
And so they felt very sensitive to the kind of pressure the Reagan-Bush administration was bringing.
Oh, that's pretty obvious today, and pretty obvious particularly during the initial stages of the Iraq War.
Right.
Yeah, well, there are other examples I thought of, and also some in Amy Goodman's book. I don't know if you read her book. I forgot what it's called right now. But anyway, she just wrote a book, and one of the examples in there was about the Chiquita. The guy wrote the articles about Chiquita, exposing their what they did in South America with the banana plantations and the workers there. And eventually those people were fired, even though the story was true, and they got them on some kind of technicality. There was also the group in California at the San Jose Mercury that was exposing the CIA drug scandals.
Well, it was Gary Webb, and basically my role in that was that in late 1985, Brian Barger and I at AP wrote the first story about the Contra drug problem, and it was real. Many of the Contra units were getting involved in drug trafficking because they were short of money and needed ways to support themselves. And the U.S. government knew it. The Reagan administration knew what was happening, but they didn't want to bring any attention to it because Reagan had said these guys were the moral equals of the founding fathers, and they felt this was a major foreign policy initiative in Nicaragua. So they looked the other way. And actually, the one person who took up our story back in 85 was a senator named John Kerry, who did his own investigation, and which was a very heroic investigation. And he ended up showing, based again on government information, that the Reagan administration did know about these problems and did look the other way. It was essentially buried then for years until Gary Webb and the San Jose Mercury News did a series called Dark Alliance, which may have been a bit over the top, but it revived this issue that the Contra drugs had helped fuel the drug problem in L.A. That came under heavy attack, not just from the government, but from the New York Times and the Washington Post and other major news organizations, which had bungled the story back in the 80s. It took the CIA, and because of the pressure on Gary Webb and on the Mercury News, Webb's career was ended. He was effectively forced out of journalism. I don't think he's ever worked in journalism since. However, the CIA did a fairly honest Inspector General's report done by Frederick Kitts, who was IG at the time. And it came out with two reports in 1998 corroborating virtually everything John Kerry had alleged back in the mid to late 1980s. And while it disputed some aspects of Webb's series, it essentially showed that the U.S. government had been aware of the serious problem and had blocked investigations into the Contra drug problem to avoid political embarrassment for the Reagan-Bush administration. It's a stunning scandal. But even then, even though the New York Times was finally forced to sort of acknowledge that it kind of missed the story, it never got the play it deserved. And Gary Webb's career was ruined in the mix.
So I would say we've often commented here on Left Out that I think the these kinds of things are the biggest problem that faces the country, because it seems to me that the very structure of our government it depends on the assumption that we will have a free press and a press that has the courage to investigate things like this. And the question is, it seems to be you know, this ever louder drumbeat of right-wing interests is taking over all of the, certainly over the mainstream media outlets, and in the U.S. to the point where ignorance of the facts is the norm rather than the exception, as a recently made clear if you saw the study from the University of Maryland, the Program on International Policy Attitudes, measuring the people who are prior to the election, who are Kerry supporters versus Bush supporters, and what they knew about the facts and international affairs is quite shocking. And it sort of underlines that, you know, people, the success really of the right wing spin machine and media machine in controlling reality, what reality is for many people.
Right.
And the question is, what can we do about this? And what is the, you know, what is the right strategy for us and for our listeners? You know, here we're on Left Out, we're doing our best, but, you know, to be honest, the number of listeners we reach is rather small, and it's certainly not, you know, not going to make a tremendous difference. So the, what really can one do? We can send you money at Consortium News. That's a great thing. That's probably, you know, more effective than supporting Left Out, but it's still not up there with, you know, Fox News or
well,
other media empires.
I think it's a huge mistake for people on the liberal side to think that a few underfunded websites and a couple of little radio shows that are struggling to get an audience are going to somehow match up against Rupert Murdoch's Fox News or even Reverend Moon's Washington Times or the Limbaugh networks and all the rest of it. It's just it's like it's an artillery barrage versus some guy with a squirt gun. So you end up with this tremendous imbalance, and that's a danger to the democracy. In Secrecy and Privilege, this book that I just put out a month or so ago about how the Bush family rose, I also spend a good deal of time in the book describing what we now know about this infrastructure that was built consciously by the conservatives, and also how some of these intelligence tactics, what they called internally perception management back in the 80s. This comes out of the CIA, which has always had this history of trying to control populations. That's what they're really about in most ways. They do propaganda. And so their goal was to figure out how they could control usually target populations, but because the American people became such a problem in the 70s around the Vietnam War, around Watergate, and around the scandals that affected the CIA that came out in the mid to late 1970s, that there was a desire to sort of somehow get the American people back in place. And one phrase was to kill the Vietnam syndrome.
Yeah, I love
that
one.
That became an important, basically a foreign policy goal, a national security goal, if you will, for that administration in the 1980s. That has continued. This idea that if you can control how Americans perceive events overseas, you will keep them in line. And I think the ultimate victory of perception management is what we see with Iraq, that you still have a large portion of the population believing the propaganda they were fed prior to the war and in those first few months after the war. If you remember, every time we turned on MSNBC, they were discovering some 55-gallon barrel of
chemicals. That was amazing.
Saying it was,
yes,
WMD. And so, of course, the American people are going to be confused. And very few news organizations had the courage to really question that, because if you did question it, much like Scott Ritter did, who was the former arms inspector, who was saying he didn't think there was any WMD, and he was essentially destroyed in terms of being accepted in the mainstream because he took that outrageous position, which turned out to be true.
Absolutely true.
But these examples make it very difficult for a reporter working at a major news organization to put himself or herself on the line and say, I'm really questioning this intelligence we're getting from the Bush administration, because what if you're wrong? I mean, no one probably will remember if you're right, and if it turns out they do find WMD, you better believe that your career's over.
Yeah.
So the logical thing for a reporter to do is bend toward them and try not to be too exposed on those kinds of issues, because the danger is enormous to your career if you're exposed on those issues to the right. There's very little danger if you're, you know, if the liberals get mad at you, so what?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As we've seen, reporters who turned out to be dead wrong on WMD at the are still there.
Judith Miller.
Yeah. Well, just a second. I want to interrupt with one thing. The phone number to call is 412-621-9728 or 89728 on campus. This is Left Out on WRCT. We're talking with Robert Perry, who is a founder of Consortium News and a reporter from way back, talking about the media and how it's how the right wing has used and created and used the media for its own purposes, and how the left has done nothing basically in response to that.
So good. So the question I was really wanted to push on, though, is what now? I mean, how do we make a change? What can you envision could possibly happen at this stage of the game? Sometimes I think the war has been lost.
Well, I'm not going to argue at that point.
I was afraid you'd say that.
I think whatever happens is going to be very difficult and probably awfully painful. As much as I think there has to be an effort to establish the real facts, to establish the real history of this period, and that we need to do our jobs and get that to the American people, I'm not sure how doable it is in any large scale way. I mean, certainly it's helpful to provide any honest information you can to anybody, but whether it can ultimately turn a tide is another question. I guess I would say if
Robert?
I were talking to some of these wealthy liberals, I'd say they better put their money where their mouth is.
Robert, we have a phone call on the line. The caller, go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, you know, why doesn't the American people take on the FCC? Because they're the ones who set the policies as to what is allowed over the airwaves.
Well, that's a very good point. Obviously, Michael Powell is the chairman of the FCC at this point. And he's taken a fairly much a free market kind of approach toward deregulatory approach toward the industry. And that certainly has followed a pattern that's been evolving over the past decade or so. The trouble is, how do the American, sort of a chicken egg thing, how do the American people get the government to take action when the media is so bad at this point that it's very hard to pull the American people together in any meaningful direction to force reform? How do you get that sort of grassroots thing going?
Well,
go ahead, caller.
It seems like citizens' best bet for getting anything done in their community or in their state is through their representative. But if people aren't aware of the problem, and if the representative isn't very familiar with interacting with the FCC or any of the other agencies that might need to be involved, then yeah, that might be a problem.
You know, I'm not sure the FCC is really the culprit for the long-term problems that we've seen. I mean, lately they've changed the rules and they've made things potentially even worse, but this was happening for decades before the FCC, you know, caved on all those ownership rules and things like that. And one thing that, just to mention the FCC, the there was a suit filed after the movie Outfoxed came out. They filed a lawsuit or some sort of claim in the FCC saying that their tagline, which is fair and balanced, is false advertising. And that's one thing that the FCC is supposed to actually regulate. You know, you can't lie in your advertising. And so this was a line that they thought maybe they could get into this crack.
So what do you suppose the chances are of Powell's FCC doing anything about that? He asked rhetorically.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the call.
All right.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to Left Out.
Yeah, go ahead, Bob.
You can reach us at 412-268 or 621-9728 or 268-9728 on campus, or send mail to bob@leftout.info. We're talking to Robert Perry, who is the founder of consortiumnews.com and is a career journalist who's worked in investigative journalism and politics, and particularly on the exposing the Iran-Contra scandal back in the 1980s. And we're talking about the effectiveness with which the right-wing interests in the United States have deployed the news media to get their message across and really also stamp out any other message really rather effectively.
I think we should talk for another couple of minutes and then move on to other topics. But one other question I wanted to bring up, that on Democracy Now! Today, they interviewed a guy named John Perkins, who has just written a book called Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Bob, did you happen to hear that interview?
No, I'm sorry, I didn't.
Oh, okay. Well, it was an amazing thing that this person, John Perkins, was basically a person who would go into all through starting from the 60s and 70s, doing economic arrangements with through corporations, but indirectly through the government, economic to countries like Ecuador and Panama, and getting them to bend to his will. And that's what they were called, the economic hitmen. And that's maybe a topic for a future show. I just thought you may have something to say about that. I thought that was an interesting thing, because basically the left has been saying these things all along, that the World Bank and the IMF is basically a mechanism to screw these small countries, and this has been said by Chomsky and Naomi Klein and others for decades, but now it's coming out. This an insider has actually laid it all out and said, yeah, this is exactly what we're doing, and I don't know how the mainstream is going to continue to deny but they will. They'll just ignore it, I guess.
Well, one of the interesting things about this past year or so, and probably one of the most hopeful aspects of all this, is that you have seen people inside the government bureaucracy speaking up, and you saw it, obviously, at the high levels from Treasury Secretary O'Neill, who comes from Pittsburgh, of course, who was a very serious man. I mean, people could criticize certain parts of his policies, but he ran Alcoa. He was he'd worked in previous Republican administrations, and came out of this administration shocked at the disdain for reality and information that he saw. And he, of course, gave interviews to Ron Suskind, who wrote them up in the book The Price of Loyalty. So at the high levels, you're getting people like O'Neill blowing the whistle, although obviously it didn't seem to have that much effect on the population at large in the election. Then you've also had people like Richard Clark, who was the counterterrorism czar, saying that,
of course,
again, that the that there wasn't, he did a book as well on this, that there was a great deal of fantasy thinking about what was happening with Iraq and the failure to focus on the real dangers of terrorism. Now, obviously, whenever these folks come out, though, then there's this drumbeat of attack from the conservative press corps.
And how?
They are demonized. They are ridiculed. They are called partisans. They're discredited with a lot of Americans. And most Americans are then kind of confused. You know, why is O'Neill, the Treasury Secretary, saying all these things? He must be a flake, or there are all these things that are done to these people, which does two things. One, it confuses the public, but it also discourages other people from inside the bureaucracy to come out and say, hold it. The American people are not being told the straight story.
Well, I think with that, I think we'll close up this segment of the show. We've been talking with Robert Perry, who's the founder of ConsortiumNews.com. Thank you very much for appearing on the program. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
So, listeners are welcome to call us at 412-621-9728 or 89728, or send mail to bob@leftout.info. We'll take a brief break, and then we'll come back shortly.